defense against the adult bully, the fellow who likes to throw his meager weight around. A few months ago, at the reservations desk of a Memphis hotel, I saw an excellent demonstration of the right way to handle folks like this. It was shortly after 5 p.m., and the hotel was busy registering new guests. The fellow ahead of me gave his name to the clerk in a commanding way. The clerk said, "Yes, sir, Mr. R., we have a fine single for you." "Single?" shouted the fellow. "I ordered a double." The clerk said, very politely, "Let me check, sir." He pulled the guest's reservation from the file and said, "I'm sorry, sir, your telegram specified a single. I'd be happy to put you in a double room, sir, if we had any available, but we simply do not." Then the irate customer said, "I don't care what the H that piece of paper says, I want a double." Then he started in with that "do you know who I am" bit, followed with, "I'll have you fired, you'll see, I'll have you fired." As best he could, under the verbal tornado, the young clerk injected, "Sir, we're terribly sorry, but we acted on your instructions." Finally, the customer, really furious now, said, "I wouldn't stay in the best suite in this blank-blank hotel now that I know how badly managed it is," and stormed out. I stepped up to the desk, thinking the clerk, who had taken one of the worst public tongue-lashings I'd seen in some time, would be upset. Instead, he greeted me with one of the finest "good evening, sirs" I'd ever heard. As he went through the routine of processing my room, I said to him, "I certainly admire the way you handled yourself just a moment ago. You have tremendous temper control." "Well, sir," he said, "I really can't get mad at a fellow like that. You see, he really isn't mad at me. I was just the scapegoat. The poor fellow may be in bad trouble with his wife, or his business may be off, or maybe he feels inferior and this was his golden chance to feel like a wheel. I'm just the guy who gave him a chance to get something out of his system." The clerk added, "Underneath, he's probably a very nice guy. Most folks are." Walking toward the elevators, I caught myself repeating aloud, "Underneath, he's probably a very nice guy. Most folks are." Remember those two short sentences next time someone declares war on you. Hold your fire. The way to win in situations like this is to let the other fellow blow his stack and then forget it. Several years ago, while checking student examination papers, I came across one that especially disturbed me. The student who wrote the examination had demonstrated in class discussions and previous tests that he was far better qualified than his paper indicated. He was, in fact, the fellow who I thought would finish at the top of the class. Instead, his paper put him at the bottom. As was my custom in such cases, I had my secretary call the student and ask him to come by my office on an urgent matter. Paul W. appeared shortly. He looked as though he had been through a terrible experience. After he was comfortably seated, I said to him, "What happened, Paul? This just isn't the quality paper I expected you to write." Paul struggled with himself, looked in the direction of his feet, and replied, "Sir, after I saw that you had spotted me cheating, I just went to pieces. I couldn't concentrate on anything. Honest, this is the first time I've ever cheated at the university. I desperately wanted an A, so I worked up a little pony to use." He was terribly upset. But now that he was talking, he wouldn't stop. "I suppose you'll have to recommend me for dismissal. The university rule says any student found cheating in any manner is subject to permanent dismissal." Here Paul started bringing up the shame this incident would bring to his family, how it would wreck his life, and all sorts of repercussions. Finally, I said, "Hold it now. Slow down. Let me explain something. I didn't see you cheat. Until you walked in and told me, I hadn't the faintest idea that was the trouble. I am sorry, Paul, that you did." Then I continued, "Paul, tell me, just what do you want to gain from your university experience?" He was a little calmer now, and after a short pause he said, "Well, doctor, I think my overall aim is to learn how to live. But I guess I'm failing pretty badly." "We learn in different ways," I said. "I think you can learn a real success lesson from this experience. When you used your pony in there, your conscience bothered you terribly. This gave you a guilt complex that in turn broke your confidence. As you expressed it, you went to pieces. Most of the time, Paul, this matter of right and wrong is approached from a moral or religious standpoint. Now understand, I'm not here to preach to you, give you a sermon about right and wrong. But let's look at the practical side. When you do anything that goes contrary to your conscience, you feel guilty. And this guilty feeling jams your thought processes. You can't think straight because your mind is asking, "Will I get caught? Will I get caught?" "Paul," I continued, "you wanted an A so badly you did something you knew was wrong. There are many times in life when you'll want to make an A so badly you'll be tempted to do something that is contrary to your conscience. For example, someday you may want to make a sale so badly you'll think of deliberately misleading the customer to buy. And you may succeed. But here's what will happen. Your guilty feeling will grab hold of you, and the next time you see your customer, you'll be self-conscious, ill at ease. You'll be wondering, has he discovered that I put something over? Your presentation will be ineffective because you can't concentrate. Chances are you'll never make the second, third, fourth, and the many repeat sales. In the long run, making that sale using tactics that hurt your conscience will cost you a lot of income." I went on and pointed out to Paul how an occasional business or professional man loses his grip because of an intense fear that his wife will learn about a secret love affair he is having with another woman. Will she find out? Will she find out? Eats away the man's confidence until he can't do a good job at work or in the home. I reminded Paul that many criminals are captured not because any clues point to them, but because they act guilty and self-conscious. Their guilt feeling puts them on the suspect list. There is within each of us a desire to be right, think right, and act right. When we go against that desire, we put a cancer in our conscience. This cancer grows and grows by eating away at our confidence. Avoid doing anything that will cause you to ask yourself, "Will I get caught? Will they find out? Will I get away with it?" Don't try to make an A if it means violating your confidence. Paul, I'm pleased to say, got the point. He learned the practical value of doing what's right. I then proposed he sit down and retake the examination. In answer to his question, "But what about my dismissal?" I said, "I know what the regulations say about cheating. But you know, if we dismissed all students who have cheated in any way, half the professors would have to leave. And if we dismissed all students who thought about cheating, the university would have to shut down. So I'm forgetting this whole incident, if you'll do me a favor." "Gladly," he said. I walked over to my bookshelf, took down my personal copy of 50 Years with the Golden Rule, and said, "Paul, read this book and return it. See how, in J.C. Penney's own words, just doing what's right made him one of America's richest men." Doing what's right keeps your conscience satisfied, and this builds self-confidence. When we do what is known to be wrong, two negative things happen. First, we feel guilt, and this guilt eats away confidence. Second, other people, sooner or later, find out and lose confidence in us. Do what's right and keep your confidence. That's thinking yourself to success. Here is a psychological principle that is worth listening to repeatedly until it absolutely saturates you. To think confidently, act confidently. The great psychologist, Dr. George W. Crane, said in his famous book, Applied Psychology, "Remember, motions are the precursors of emotions. You can't control the latter directly, but only through your choice of motions or actions. To avoid this all-too-common tragedy, marital difficulties and misunderstandings, become aware of the true psychological facts. Go through the proper motions each day, and you'll soon begin to feel the corresponding emotions. Just be sure you and your mate go through those motions of dates and kisses, the phrasing of sincere daily compliments, plus the many other little courtesies, and you need not worry about the emotion of love. You can't act devoted for very long without feeling devoted. Psychologists tell us we can change our attitudes by changing our physical actions. For example, you actually feel more like smiling if you make yourself smile. You feel more superior when you make yourself stand tall than when you slouch. On the negative side, frown a really bitter frown and see if you don't feel more like frowning. It is easy to prove that managed motions can change emotions. People who are shy in introducing themselves can replace this timidity with confidence just by taking three simple actions simultaneously. First, reach for the other person's hand and clasp it warmly. Second, look directly at the other person. And third, say, "I'm very glad to know you." These three simple actions automatically and instantaneously banish shyness. Confident action produces confident thinking. So, to think confidently. Act the way you want to feel. Here are five confidence-building exercises. Listen to these guides carefully, then make a conscious effort to practice them and build your confidence. 1. Be a front-seater. Ever notice in meetings, in church, classrooms, and other kinds of assemblies, how the back seats fill up first? Most folks scramble to sit in the back rows so they won't be too conspicuous. And the reason they are afraid to be conspicuous is that they lack confidence. Sitting up front builds confidence. Practice it. From now on, make it a rule to sit as close to the front as you can. Sure, you may be a little more conspicuous in the front, but remember, there is nothing inconspicuous about success. 2. Practice making eye contact. How a person uses his eyes tells us a lot about him. Instinctively, you ask yourself questions about the fellow who doesn't look you in the eye. What's he trying to hide? What's he afraid of? Is he trying to put something over on me? Is he holding something back? Usually, failure to make eye contact says one of two things. It may say, "I feel weak beside you. I feel inferior to you. I'm afraid of you." Or avoiding another person's eyes may say, "I feel guilty. I've done something or I've thought something that I don't want you to know. I'm afraid if I let my eyes connect with yours, you'll see through me." You say nothing good about yourself when you avoid making eye contact. You say, "I'm afraid. I lack confidence." Conquer this fear by making yourself look the other person in the eyes. Looking the other person in the eye tells him, "I'm honest and above board. I believe in what I'm telling you. I'm not afraid. I'm confident." Make your eyes work for you. Aim them right at the other person's eyes. It not only gives you confidence, it wins you confidence too. 3. Walk 25% faster. When I was a youngster, just going to the county seat was a big treat. After all the errands were accomplished and we were back in the car, my mother would often say, "Davy, let's just sit here a while and watch the people walk by." Mother was an excellent game player. She'd say, "See that fellow? What do you suppose is troubling him?" Or, "What do you think that lady there is going to do?" Or, "Look at that person. He just seems to be in a fog." Watching people walk and move about became real fun. It was a lot cheaper than the movies, which was one of the reasons I learned later that Mother developed the game, and it was a lot more instructive. I still am a walk watcher. In corridors, lobbies, on sidewalks, I still occasionally find myself studying human behavior simply by watching people move about. Psychologists link slovenly posture and sluggish walking to unpleasant attitudes toward oneself, work, and the people around us. But psychologists also tell us you can actually change your attitudes by changing your posture and speed of movement. Watch, and you discover that body action is the result of mind action. The extremely beaten people, the real down-and-outers, just shuffle and stumble along. They have zero self-confidence. Average people have the average walk. Their pace is average. They have the look of, I really don't have very much pride in myself. Then there's a third group. Persons in this group show super confidence. They walk faster than the average. There seems to be a slight sprint in the way they walk. Their walk tells the world, I've got someplace important to go, something important to do. What's more, I will succeed at what I will do 15 minutes from now. Use the walk 25% faster technique to help build self-confidence. Throw your shoulders back, lift up your head, move ahead just a little faster, and feel self-confidence grow. Just try and see. 4. Practice speaking up. In working with many kinds of groups of all sizes, I've watched many persons with keen perception and much native ability freeze and fail to participate in discussions. It isn't that these folks don't want to get in and wade with the rest. Rather, it's a simple lack of confidence. The conference clam thinks to himself, my opinion is probably worthless. If I say something, I'll probably look foolish. I'll just say nothing. Besides, the others in the group probably know more than I. I don't want the others to know how ignorant I am. Each time the conference clam fails to speak, he feels even more inadequate, more inferior. Often he makes a faint promise to himself that deep down he knows he won't keep, to speak next time. This is very important. Each time our clam fails to speak, he takes one more dose of confidence poison. He becomes less and less confident of himself. But on the positive side, the more you speak up, the more you add to your confidence, and the easier it is to speak up the next time. Speak up. It's a confidence-building vitamin. Put this confidence builder to use. Make it a rule to speak up at every open meeting you attend. Speak up. Say something voluntarily at every business conference, committee meeting, community forum you attend. Make no exception. Comment, make a suggestion, ask a question, and don't be the last to speak. Try to be the icebreaker, the first one in with a comment. And never worry about looking foolish. You won't. For each person who doesn't agree with you, odds are another person will. Quit asking yourself, I wonder if I dare speak. Instead, concentrate on getting the discussion leader's attention so you can speak. For special training and experience in speaking, consider joining your local Toastmasters Club. Thousands of conscientious people have developed confidence through a planned program to feel at ease talking with people and to people. 5. Smile big. Most folks have heard at one time or another that a smile will give them a real boost. They've been told that a smile is excellent medicine for confidence deficiency. But lots of people still don't really believe this because they've never tried smiling when they feel fear. Make this little test. Try to feel defeated and smile big at the same time. You can't. A big smile gives you confidence. A big smile beats fear, rolls away worry, defeats despondency. And a real smile does more than cure just your ill feeling. A real smile melts away the opposition of others, and instantly, too. Another person simply can't be angry with you if you give him a big, sincere smile. Just the other day, a little incident happened to me that illustrates this. I was parked at an intersection, waiting for the light to change, when bam, The driver behind me had let his foot slip the brake and put my rear bumper to a test. I looked back through my mirror and saw him getting out. I got out, too, and forgetting the rule book, started preparing myself for verbal combat. I confess I was ready verbally to bite him to pieces. But fortunately, before I got the chance, he walked up to me, smiled, and said in the most earnest voice, "Friend, I really didn't mean to do that." That smile, matched with his sincere comment, melted me. I mumbled something about, "That's okay. Happens all the time." Almost in less time than it takes to wink an eye, my opposition turned into friendship. Smile big and you feel like happy days are here again. But smile big. A half-developed smile is not fully guaranteed. Smile until your teeth show. That large-size smile is fully guaranteed. I've heard many times, "Yes, but when I fear something or when I'm angry, I don't feel like smiling." Of course you don't. No one does. The trick is to tell yourself forcefully, "I'm going to smile." Then smile. Harness the power of smiling. Put these 5 procedures to work for you. 1. Action cures fear. Isolate your fear and then take constructive action. Inaction, doing nothing about a situation, strengthens fear and destroys confidence. 2. Make a supreme effort to put only positive thoughts in your memory bank. Don't let negative, self-deprecatory thoughts grow into mental monsters. Simply refuse to recall unpleasant events or situations. 3. Put people in proper perspective. Remember, people are more alike, much more alike, than they are different. Get a balanced view of the other fellow. He is just another human being. And develop an understanding attitude. Many people will bark, but it's a rare one who bites. 4. Practice doing what your conscience tells you is right. This prevents a poisonous guilt complex from developing. Doing what's right is a very practical rule for success. 5. Make everything about you say, "I'm confident, really confident." Practice these little techniques in your day-to-day activities. Be a front-seater. Make eye contact. Walk 25% faster. Speak up. Smile big. Chapter 4. How to Think Big. Recently, I chatted with a recruitment specialist for one of the nation's largest industrial organizations. 4 months each year, she visits college campuses to recruit graduating seniors for her company's junior executive training program. The tenor of her remarks indicated that she was discouraged about the attitudes of many people she talked with. Most days, I interview between 8 and 12 college seniors, all in the upper third of their class, all at least mildly interested in coming with us. One of the main things we want to determine in the screening interview is the individual's motivation. We want to find out if he or she is the kind of person who can, in a few years, direct major projects, manage a branch office or plant, or in some other way make a really substantial contribution to the company. I must say I'm not too pleased with the personal objectives of most of those I talk with. "You'd be surprised," she went on, "how many 22-year-olds are more interested in our retirement plan than in anything else we have to offer?" A second favorite question is, "Will I move around a lot?" Most of them seem to define the word success as synonymous with security. Can we risk turning our company over to people like that? The thing I can't understand is why should young people these days be so ultra-conservative, so narrow in their view of the future? Every day there are more signs of expanding opportunity. This country is making record progress in scientific and industrial development. Our population is gaining rapidly. If there ever was a time to be bullish about America, it's now. The tendency for so many people to think small means there is less competition than you think for a very rewarding career. Where success is concerned, people are not measured in inches or pounds or college degrees or family background. They are measured by the size of their thinking. How big we think determines the size of our accomplishments. Now, let's see how we can enlarge our thinking. Ever ask yourself, what is my greatest weakness? Probably the greatest human weakness is self-deprecation, that is, selling oneself short. Self-deprecation shows through in countless ways. John sees a job advertisement in the paper. It's exactly what he would like. But he does nothing about it because he thinks, I'm not good enough for that job, so why bother? Or Jim wants a date with Joan, but he doesn't call her because he thinks he wouldn't rate with her. Tom feels Mr. Richards would be a very good prospect for his product, but Tom doesn't call. He feels Mr. Richards is too big to see him. Pete is filling out a job application form. One question asks, what beginning salary do you expect? Pete puts down a modest figure because he feels he really isn't worth the bigger sum he would like to earn. Philosophers for thousands of years have issued good advice, know thyself. But most people, it seems, interpret this suggestion to mean know only thy negative self. Most self-evaluation consists of making long mental lists of one's faults, shortcomings, inadequacies. It's well to know our inabilities, for this shows us areas in which we can improve. But if we know only our negative characteristics, we're in a mess. Our value is small. Here is an exercise to help you measure your true size. I've used it in training programs for executives and sales personnel. It works. 1. Determine your 5 chief assets. Invite some objective friend to help, possibly your wife, your superior, a professor, some intelligent person who will give you an honest opinion. Examples of assets frequently listed are education, experience, technical skills, appearance, well-adjusted home life, attitudes, personality, initiative. 2. Next, under each asset, write the names of 3 persons you know who have achieved large success but who do not have this asset to as great a degree as you. When you've completed this exercise, you will find you outrank many successful people on at least one asset. There is only one conclusion you can honestly reach. You're bigger than you think. So fit your thinking to your true size. Think as big as you really are. Never, never, never sell yourself short. The person who says adamantine, when in plain talk he means immovable, or says coquette, when we would understand him better if he said flirt, may have a big vocabulary. But does he have a big thinker's vocabulary? Probably not. People who use difficult, high-sounding words and phrases that most folks have to strain themselves to understand are inclined to be overbearing and stuffed shirts. And stuffed shirts are usually small thinkers. The important measure of a person's vocabulary is not the size or the number of words he uses. Rather, the thing that counts, the only thing that counts about one's vocabulary, is the effect his words and phrases have on his own and others' thinking. Here is something very basic. We do not think in words and phrases. We think only in pictures and/or images. Words are the raw materials of thought. When spoken or read, that amazing instrument, the mind, automatically converts words and phrases into mind pictures. Each word, each phrase, creates a slightly different mind picture. If someone tells you, Jim bought a new split level, you see one picture. But if you're told, Jim bought a new ranch house, you see another picture. The mind pictures we see are modified by the kinds of words we use to name things and describe things. Look at it this way. When you speak or write, you are, in a sense, a projector showing movies in the minds of others, and the pictures you create determine how you and others react. Suppose you tell a group of people, "I'm sorry to report we've failed." What do these people see? They see defeat and all the disappointment and grief the word failed conveys. Now suppose you said instead, "Here's a new approach that I think will work." They would feel encouraged, ready to try again. Suppose you say, "We face a problem." You have created a picture in the minds of others of something difficult, unpleasant to solve. Instead say, "We face a challenge," and you create a mind picture of fun, sport, something pleasant to do. Or tell a group, "We incurred a big expense," and people see money spent that will never return. Indeed, this is unpleasant. Instead say, "We made a big investment," and people see a picture of something that will return profits later on, a very pleasant sight. The point is this. Big thinkers are specialists in creating positive, forward-looking, optimistic pictures in their own minds and in the minds of others. To think big, we must use words and phrases that produce big, positive mental images. Here are examples of phrases that create small, negative, depressing thoughts. And then, the same situation is discussed, but in a big, positive way. As you listen to these, ask yourself, what mind pictures do I see? Phrases that create small, negative mind images. 1. "It's no use, we're whipped." Or, phrases that create big, positive mind images. "We're not whipped yet, let's keep trying, here's a new angle." 2. "I was in that business once and failed, never again." Or, "I went broke, but it was my own fault. I'm going to try again." 3. "I've tried, but the product won't sell. People don't want it." Or, "So far I've not been able to sell this product, but I know it is good, and I'm going to find the formula that will put it over." 4. "The market is saturated. Imagine, 75% of the potential has already been sold. Better get out." Or, "Imagine, 25% of the market is still not sold. Count me in. This looks big." 5. "Their orders have been small. Cut them off." Or, "Their orders have been small. Let's map out a plan for selling them more of their needs." 6. "5 years is too long a time to spend before I'll get into the top ranks in your company. Count me out." Or, "5 years is not really a long time. Just think. That leaves me 30 years to serve at a high level." 7. "The competition has all the advantage. How do you expect me to sell against them?" Or, "Competition is strong, there's no denying that. But no one ever has all the advantages. Let's put our heads together and figure out a way to beat them at their own game." 8. "Nobody will ever want that product." Or, "In its present form, it may not be saleable, but let's consider some modifications." 9. "Let's wait until a recession comes along, then buy stocks." Or, "Let's invest now. Bet on prosperity, not depression." 10. "I'm too young, old, for the job." Or, "Being young, old, is a distinct advantage." 11. "It won't work. Let me prove it. The image, dark, gloom, disappointment, grief, failure." Or, "It will work. Let me prove it. The image, bright, hope, success, fun, victory." 4 ways to develop the big thinker's vocabulary. Here are 4 ways to help you develop a big thinker's vocabulary. 1. Use big, positive, cheerful words and phrases to describe how you feel. When someone asks, "How do you feel today?" and you respond with an, "I'm tired, I have a headache, I wish it were Saturday, I don't feel so good," you actually make yourself feel worse. Practice this. It's a very simple point, but it has tremendous power. Every time someone asks you, "How are you?" or "How are you feeling today?" respond with a, "Just wonderful. Thanks, and you?" Or say, "Great," or "Fine." Say you feel wonderful at every possible opportunity, and you will begin to feel wonderful, and bigger too. Become known as a person who always feels great. It wins friends. 2. Use bright, cheerful, favorable words and phrases to describe other people. Make it a rule to have a big, positive word for all your friends and associates. When you and someone else are discussing an absent third party, be sure you compliment him with big words and phrases like, "He's really a fine fellow. They tell me he's working out wonderfully well." Be extremely careful to avoid the petty, cut-him-down language. Sooner or later, third parties hear what's been said, and then such talk only cuts you down. 3. Use positive language to encourage others. Compliment people personally at every opportunity. Everyone you know craves praise. Have a special good word for your wife or husband every day. Notice and compliment the people who work with you. Praise, sincerely administered, is a success tool. Use it. Use it again and again and again. Compliment people on their appearance, their work, their achievements, their families. 4. Use positive words to outline plans to others. When people hear something like this, "Here is some good news. We face a genuine opportunity," their minds start to sparkle. But when they hear something like, "Whether we like it or not, we've got a job to do," the mind movie is dull and boring, and they react accordingly. Promise victory and watch eyes light up. Promise victory and win support. Build castles. Don't dig graves. See what can be, not just what is. Big thinkers train themselves to see not just what is, but what can be. Here are 4 examples to illustrate this point. 1. What gives real estate value? A highly successful realtor who specializes in rural property shows what can be done if we train ourselves to see something where little or nothing presently exists. "Most of the rural property around here," my friend began, "is run down and not very attractive. I'm successful because I don't try to sell my prospects a farm as it is. I develop my entire sales plan around what the farm can be. Simply telling the prospect, 'The farm has XX acres of bottom land and XX acres of woods and is XX miles from town,' doesn't stir him up and make him want to buy it. But when you show him a concrete plan for doing something with the farm, he's just about sold. Here, let me show you what I mean." He opened his briefcase and pulled out a file. "This farm," he said, "is a new listing with us. It's like a lot of them. It's 43 miles from the center of the metropolitan area. The house is run down, and the place hasn't been farmed in 5 years. Now here's what I've done. I spent 2 full days on the place last week, just studying it. I walked over the place several times. I looked at neighboring farms. I studied the location of the farm with respect to existing and planned highways. I asked myself, what's this farm good for? I came up with 3 possibilities. Here they are." He showed them to me. Each plan was neatly typed and looked quite comprehensive. One plan suggested converting the farm into a riding stable. The plan showed why the idea was sound: a growing city, more love for the outdoors, more money for recreation, good roads. The plan also showed how the farm could support a sizable number of horses so that the revenue from the rides would be largely clear. The whole riding stable idea was very thorough, very convincing. The plan was so clear and convincing, I could see a dozen couples riding horseback through the trees. In similar fashion, this enterprising salesman developed a second thorough plan for a tree farm and a third plan for a combination tree and poultry farm. Now, when I talk with my prospects, I won't have to convince them that the farm is a good buy as it is. I help them to see a picture of the farm changed into a money-making proposition. Besides selling more farms and selling them faster, my method of selling the property for what it can be pays off in another way. I can sell a farm at a higher price than my competitors. People naturally pay more for acreage and an idea than they do for just acreage. Because of this, more people want to list their farms with me, and my commission on each sale is larger. The moral is this. Look at things not as they are, but as they can be. Visualization adds value to everything. A big thinker always visualizes what can be done in the future. He isn't stuck with the present. 2. How much is a customer worth? A department store executive was addressing a conference of merchandise managers. She was saying, "I may be a little old-fashioned, but I belong to the school that believes the best way to get customers to come back is to give them friendly, courteous service." One day I was walking through our store when I overheard a salesperson arguing with a customer. The customer left in quite a huff. Afterward, the salesperson said to another, "I'm not going to let a $1.98 customer take up all my time and make me take the store apart trying to find him what he wants. He's simply not worth it." I walked away, the executive continued, but I couldn't get that remark out of my mind. It is pretty serious, I thought, when our salespeople think of customers as being in the $1.98 category. I decided right then that this concept must be changed. When I got back to my office, I called our research director and asked him to find out how much the average customer spent in our store last year. The figure he came up with surprised even me. According to our research director's careful calculation, the typical customer spent $362 in our establishment. The next thing I did was call a meeting of all supervisory personnel and explain the incident to them. Then I showed them what a customer is really worth. Once I got these people to see that a customer is not to be valued on a single sale, but rather on an annual basis, customer service definitely improved. The point made by the retailing executive applies to any kind of business. It's repeat business that makes the profit. Often there's no profit at all on the first several sales. Look at the potential expenditures of the customers, not just what they buy today. Putting a big value on customers is what converts them into big, regular patrons. Attaching little value to customers sends them elsewhere. A student related this pertinent incident to me, explaining why he'll never again eat in a certain cafeteria. For lunch one day, the student began, "I decided to try a new cafeteria that had just opened a couple of weeks before. Nickels and dimes are pretty important to me right now, so I watch what I buy pretty closely. Walking past the meat section, I saw some turkey and dressing that looked pretty good, and it was plainly marked 39 cents. When I got to the cash register, the checker looked at my tray and said, $1.09. I politely asked her to check it again because my tally was 99 cents. After giving me a mean glare, she recounted. The difference turned out to be the turkey. She had charged me 49 cents instead of 39 cents. Then I called her attention to the sign which read 39 cents. This really set her off. "I don't care what that sign says. It's supposed to be 49 cents. See? Here's my price list for today. Somebody back there made a mistake. You'll have to pay the 49 cents." Then I tried to explain to her the only reason I selected the turkey was because it was 39 cents. If it had been marked 49 cents, I'd have taken something else. To this, her answer was, "You'll just have to pay the 49 cents." I did, because I didn't want to stand there and create a scene. But I decided on the spot that I'd never eat there again. I spend about $250 a year for lunches, and you can be sure they'll not get one penny of it. There's an example of the little view. The checker saw one thin dime, not the potential $250. 3. The case of the blind milkman. It's surprising how people sometimes are blind to potential. A few years ago, a young milkman came to our door to solicit our dairy business. I explained to him that we already had milk delivery service, and we were quite satisfied. Then I suggested that he stop next door and talk to the lady there. To this he replied, "I've already talked to the lady next door, but they use only 1 quart of milk every 2 days, and that's not enough to make it worthwhile for me to stop." "That may be," I said, "but when you talked to our neighbor, did you not observe that the demand for milk in that household will increase considerably in a month or so? There will be a new addition over there that will consume lots of milk." The young man looked for a moment like he had been struck, and then he said, "How blind can a guy be?" Today, that same 1 quart every 2 days family buys 7 quarts every 2 days from a milkman who had some foresight. That first youngster, a boy, now has 2 brothers and 1 sister, and I'm told there'll be another young one soon. How blind can we be? See what can be, not just what is. The schoolteacher who thinks of Jimmy only as he is, an ill-mannered, backward, uncouth brat, certainly will not aid Jimmy's development. But the teacher who sees Jimmy not as he is now, but as he can be, she'll get results. Most folks driving through Skid Row see only broken-down stumble-bums, hopelessly lost to the bottle. A few devoted people see something else in the Skid Rowite. They see a reconstructed citizen. And because they see this, they succeed in many cases in doing an excellent rehabilitation job. 4. What determines how much you're worth? After a training session a few weeks ago, a young man came to see me and asked if he could talk with me for a few minutes. I knew that this young fellow, now about 26, had been a very underprivileged child. On top of this, he had experienced a mountain of misfortune in his early adult years. I also knew that he was making a real effort to prepare himself for a solid future. Over coffee, we quickly worked out his technical problem, and our discussion turned to how people who have few physical possessions should look toward the future. His comments provide a straightforward, sound answer. "I've got less than $200 in the bank. My job as a rate clerk doesn't pay much, and it doesn't carry much responsibility. My car is 4 years old, and my wife and I live in a cramped second-floor apartment." "But, Professor," he continued, "I'm determined not to let what I haven't got stop me." That was an intriguing statement, so I urged him to explain. "It's this way," he went on. "I've been analyzing people a lot lately, and I've noticed this. People who don't have much look at themselves as they are now. That's all they see. They don't see a future. They just see a miserable present. My neighbor is a good example. He's continually complaining about having a low-pay job, the plumbing that's always getting fouled up, the lucky breaks somebody else just got, the doctor bills that are piling up. He reminds himself so often that he's poor that now he just assumes that he's always going to be poor. He acts as if he were sentenced to living in that broken-down apartment all the rest of his life." My friend was really speaking from the heart, and after a moment's pause he added, "If I looked at myself strictly as I am, old car, low income, cheap apartment, and hamburger diet, I couldn't help but be discouraged. I'd see a nobody, and I'd be a nobody for the rest of my life. I've made up my mind to look at myself as the person I'm going to be in a few short years. I see myself not as a rate clerk, but as an executive. I don't see a crummy apartment. I see a fine new suburban home. And when I look at myself that way, I feel bigger and think bigger, and I've got plenty of personal experiences to prove it's paying off." Isn't that a splendid plan for adding value to oneself? This young fellow is on the expressway to really fine living. He's mastered this basic success principle. It isn't what one has that's important. Rather, it's how much one is planning to get that counts. The price tag the world puts on us is just about identical to the one we put on ourselves. Here is how you can develop your power to see what can be, not just what is. I call these the practice adding value exercises. 1. Practice adding value to things. Remember the real estate example. Ask yourself, what can I do to add value to this room or this house or this business? Look for ideas to make things worth more. A thing, whether it be a vacant lot, a house, or a business, has value in proportion to the ideas for using it. 2. Practice adding value to people. As you move higher and higher in the world of success, more and more of your job becomes people development. Ask, what can I do to add value to my subordinates? What can I do to help them to become more effective? Remember, to bring out the best in a person, you must first visualize his best. 3. Practice adding value to yourself. Conduct a daily interview with yourself. Ask, what can I do to make myself more valuable today? Visualize yourself not as you are, but as you can be. Then specific ways for attaining your potential value will suggest themselves. Just try and see. A retired owner-manager of a medium-sized printing company, 60 employees, explained to me how his successor was picked. 5 years ago, my friend began, I needed an accountant to head up our accounting and office routine. The fellow I hired was named Harry and was only 26. He knew nothing about the printing business, but his record showed he was a good accountant. Yet, a year and a half ago, when I retired, we made him president and general manager of the company. Looking back on it, Harry had one trait that put him out in front of everyone else. Harry was sincerely and actively interested in the whole company, not just writing checks and keeping records. Whenever he saw how he could help other employees, he jumped right in. The first year Harry was with me, we lost a few men. Harry came to me with a fringe benefit program which he promised would cut down turnover at low cost, and it worked. Harry did many other things too, which helped the whole company, not just this department. He made a detailed cost study of our production department and showed me how a $30,000 investment in new machinery would pay off. Once we experienced a pretty bad sales slump, Harry went to our sales manager and said, in effect, I don't know much about the sales end of the business, but let me try to help. And he did. Harry came up with several good ideas, which helped us sell more jobs. When a new employee joined us, Harry was right there to help the fellow get comfortable. Harry took a real interest in the entire operation. When I retired, Harry was the only logical person to take over. But don't misunderstand, my friend continued. Harry didn't try to put himself over on me. He wasn't a mere meddler. He wasn't aggressive in a negative way. He didn't stab people in the back, and he didn't go around giving orders. He just went around helping. Harry simply acted as if everything in the company affected him. He made company business his business. We can all learn a lesson from Harry. The I'm doing my job and that's enough attitude is small, negative thinking. Big thinkers see themselves as members of a team effort, as winning or losing with the team, not by themselves. They help in every way they can, even when there is no direct and immediate compensation or other reward. The fellow who shrugs off a problem outside his own department with the comment, well, that's no concern of mine, let them worry about it, hasn't got the attitude it takes for top leadership. Practice this. Practice being a big thinker. See the company's interest as identical with your own. Probably only a very few persons working in large companies have a sincere, unselfish interest in their company. But after all, only a relatively few persons qualify as big thinkers. And these few are the ones eventually rewarded with the most responsible, best-paying jobs. Many, many potentially powerful people let petty, small, insignificant things block their way to achievement. Let's look at four examples. 1. What does it take to make a good speech? Just about everyone wishes he had the ability to do a first-class job of speaking in public. But most people don't get their wish. Most folks are lousy public speakers. Why? The reason is simple. Most people concentrate on the small, trivial things of speaking at the expense of the big, important things. In preparing to give a talk, most people give themselves a host of mental instructions, like, I've got to remember to stand straight. Don't move around and don't use your hands. Don't let the audience see you use your notes. Remember, don't make mistakes in grammar. Especially don't say, for he and I. Say, for him and me. Be sure your tie is straight. Speak loud, but not too loud. And so on and so on. Now, what happens when the speaker gets up to speak? He's scared because he's given himself a terrific list of things not to do. He gets confused in his talk and finds himself silently asking, have I made a mistake? He is, in brief, a flop. He's a flop because he concentrated on the petty, trivial, relatively unimportant qualities of a good speaker and failed to concentrate on the big things that make a good speaker. Knowledge of what he's going to talk about and an intense desire to tell it to other people. The real test of a speaker is not did he stand straight or did he make any mistakes in grammar, but rather did the audience get the points he wanted to put across. Most of our top speakers have petty defects. Some of them even have unpleasant voices. Some of the most sought-after speakers in America would flunk a speech course taught by the old negative, don't do this and don't do that method. Yet all these successful public speakers have one thing in common. They have something to say, and they feel a burning desire for other people to hear it. Don't let concern with trivia keep you from speaking successfully in public. 2. What causes quarrels? Ever stop to ask yourself just what causes quarrels? At least 99% of the time, quarrels start over petty, unimportant matters like this. John comes home a little tired, a little on edge. Dinner doesn't exactly please him, so he turns up his nose and complains. Joan's day wasn't perfect either, so she rallies to her own defense with, well, what do you expect on my food budget? Or, maybe I could cook better if I had a new stove like everybody else. This insults John's pride, so he attacks with, now, Joan, it's not lack of money. It's simply that you don't know how to manage. And away they go. Before a truce is finally declared, all sorts of accusations are made by each party. In-laws, sex, money, premarital and postmarital promises, and other issues will be introduced. Both parties leave the battle nervous, tense. Nothing has been settled, and both parties have new ammunition to make the next quarrel more vicious. Little things, petty thinking, causes arguments. So, to eliminate quarrels, eliminate petty thinking. Here's a technique that works. Before complaining or accusing or reprimanding someone or launching a counterattack in self-defense, ask yourself, is it really important? In most cases, it isn't, and you avoid conflict. Ask yourself, is it really important if he or she is messy with cigarettes or forgets to put the cap on the toothpaste or is late coming home? Is it really important if he or she squandered a little money or invited some people in I don't like? When you feel like taking negative action, ask yourself, is it really important? That question works magic in building a finer home situation. It works at the office, too. It works in home-going traffic when another driver cuts in ahead of you. It works in any situation in life that is apt to produce quarrels. 3. John got the smallest office and fizzled out. Several years ago, I observed small thinking about an office assignment destroy a young fellow's chances for a profitable career in advertising. 4 young executives, all on the same status level, were moved into new offices. 3 of the offices were identical in size and decoration. The 4th was smaller and less elaborate. J.M. was assigned the 4th office. This turned out to be a real blow to his pride. Immediately, he felt discriminated against. Negative thinking, resentment, bitterness, jealousy built up. J.M. began to feel inadequate. The result was that J.M. grew hostile toward his fellow executives. Rather than cooperate, he did his best to undermine their efforts. Things got worse. 3 months later, J.M. slipped so badly that management had no choice but to issue him a pink slip. Small thinking over a very small matter stopped J.M. In his head,